This is Nightly Business Report with Tyler Matheson and Sue Herrera.
Different directions, two stocks, two Dow components, two very different stories, Home Depot and General Electric.
Return of uncertainty. Is there a shift underway in the stock market that could cause the rally to fizzle?
Who's next? Why there's an appetite for acquisitions in the casual dining and fast food industries. Those stories and more tonight on Nightly Business Report for this Tuesday, November the 14th. Good evening, everybody. I'm Bill Griffith here at the New York Stock Exchange in tonight for Tyler Matheson. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Bill. Great to have you. I'm Sue Herrera. Good evening, everybody. It is turning into a tale of two blue chip stocks. Home Depot has a lot working in its favor. General Electric right now, anyway, does not. So let's begin tonight with Home Depot. The home improvement retailer not only beat earnings and revenue estimates, it also saw same-store sales blow past expectations, and it raised its outlook. The stock rose on the report, adding to its 25% gain so far this year. Courtney Reagan starts us off.
While many areas of retail are at best inconsistent right now, home improvement retail remains robust, especially for Home Depot. The retailer posting another strong quarter, blowing past expectations and upping its forecast for the remainder of the year. Home Depot has been riding on the strength of the U.S. housing market for years now, and this most recent quarter got an additional nearly $300 million lift from hurricane-related spending, both prep and rebuilding.
The storms are only one piece of the story here. The company's also riding the waves of a very good housing cycle, very good macroeconomic environment. And to the extent we see housing continue to maintain its steady growth, we think that Home Depot should be able to outperform, especially when you consider the fact that they execute much better than Lowe's right now.
Both the average purchase amount and the number of transactions grew in the quarter. More than 20% of Home Depot sales are to professionals, like contractors. That group buys more expensive items. That big-ticket merchandise, like flooring, priced at $900 and up, rose 12% in the quarter. And the retailer says sales of less expensive products to do-it-yourselfers increased, too. While Home Depot is the world's largest seller of Christmas trees, the holiday season isn't its biggest time of the year for sales. That's the spring planting season. Still, the retailer expects a strong fourth quarter, partially driven by continued hurricane recovery sales and continued strong housing trends. On the earnings call, the executives said if the first 2 weeks of November are any indication, their forecast may be conservative. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Courtney Reagan.
And as Sue said, it's a different story for General Electric. Now, we told you yesterday about the company's restructuring plan, and today we heard directly from the new CEO. But here on Wall Street, analysts remain skeptical, and the stock fell even further today. Morgan Brennan has our details for us tonight.
Shares of General Electric plunged again today as the blue-chip stock logged its worst weekly performance since 2009, or at the depths of the financial recession. GE CEO and Chairman John Flannery says he's very clear on the direction of the struggling industrial and that he's, quote, confident he can turn it around.
If you go back and look, this is very, very similar to what I experienced in healthcare. I walked in, I had a look and said, this is fundamentally a very good business, and there's some basic things around operating rigor and capital allocation and how we work as a team that make a difference. So I'm feeling very much the same way again, but I recognize that it's, as I said yesterday, it's show me time.
Flannery detailed why the new financial forecast is so much weaker than previously disclosed, arguing that the drop in profits and cash flow couldn't have been known before. He also addressed the decision to cut the dividend in half, a big move for a company with a shareholder base that's 40% retail.
I don't underestimate in any sense, and I feel this deeply, the gravity of what we have had to do and the people that rely on that dividend, especially the people who are relying on this for current income. This is a very, very tough measure. And so it's not anything we took lightly. I looked at this in very great detail. And I just felt in the end it was something we had to do.
Flannery also said he's not surprised by the stock's double-digit plunge over the past 2 days because GE had, quote, disappointing news. On why investors should buy right now, he had this to say.
Right now, yes, why would someone buy the shares right now? I would say the outlook for the company over 3 to 5 years, what we laid it forward over 3 to 5 years, growing cash and earnings over 3 to 5 years, that's what someone should buy. So is it going to be immediate? Is it going to happen in 2 months, 4 months, 6 months? No, there's operational things we need to change to the company.
Flannery is calling 2018 a reset year, but Wall Street has heard turnaround talk from GE before. Former CEO Jeff Immelt laid out the original 2018 profit target years ago, part of his turnaround plan. Flannery just cut that in half. So there is a lot of skepticism, frustration, even anger around the Dow's oldest component right now. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Morgan Brennan.
And GE, along with concerns about the global economy and a decline in energy shares, weighed on the broader market today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to 23,409. It had been down triple digits earlier in the day. The Nasdaq was off 19, and the S&P 500 fell nearly 6. Today's pullback follows a steady rally in stocks pretty much all year. But is uncertainty starting to creep back into this market? Bob Pisani takes a look.
There's been a little bit of de-risking going on in the markets, with cyclicals like materials and industrials and energy down today, and defensive names like consumer staples and utilities on the upside. There's a different tone to the market in the last week or so. We've opened down for the last 5 trading sessions. You know, that has not happened in a very long time. Now, traders have cited several potential issues. First, we are making progress on tax cuts, but everyone now realizes it may not be as great as everyone hoped. Traders are also questioning what this flatter yield curve means. We don't have an agreement on that. And also, recent data out of China, including retail sales and industrial production, have been disappointing. And the uncertainty in the Middle East is also a new factor. The Saudis arresting high-ranking princes all happened in the last week and a half. That's corresponded to the recent market weakness. It's not clear whether Middle East sovereign wealth funds were sellers on this turmoil. Now, the S&P is only fractionally off its historic high from early last week, but there's been a notable divergence in 2 areas. First, the small-cap Russell 2000 is down about 1.4%. The S&P is up 2.5% in the last few weeks. That's a big divergence attributed partly to concerns over the tax bill. Another issue is this decline in these high yield funds. They're down again today. They're down nearly 2% for the month. There are tax issues here as well, but high yield is also a proxy for people's willingness to take risk. So the bottom line is, for the moment, the weakness in small caps is contained, but many investors are sitting on gains for the year. They're reluctant to sell now because it's easier to sit on the gains and sell in January when they'll have 16 months to pay taxes and may get a tax break to boot. But if the market starts to slip notably in the next few weeks, the need to preserve gains will trump any tax considerations, and that could lead to an end-of-the-year sell-off. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Bob Pisani at the New York Stock Exchange.
Well, let's turn to a bull and a bear for their thoughts on where this market may go from here. We have Jim Paulson, Chief Investment Officer at the Luthold Group, who is cautious on the market, so you get to be our bear. And Kevin Caron is Portfolio Manager with Washington Crossing Advisors, who is our bull. Good to see you both. As always, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to hear.
Thanks for having us, Bill.
Kevin, I think even as a bull, you admit that historically speaking, this is a rather expensive market. And what do you make of this change in tone that Bob Pisani was referring to? There are some signs of wear and tear here lately.
Yeah, we have a barometer that we've constructed, and that barometer is still pointing towards growth. And most of the data is very strong. You look at capital spending, investment spending, look at employment data, earnings. The wide swath of data is still supportive of the growth story. And until that breaks materially, or until the market begins to really question that story, we're going to stay with it. So we're still bullish, although we do acknowledge that the market is a little bit pricey here.
You know, Jim, let me turn to you, if I could, Jim, on that note, because I think you would agree that the market does look a little bit pricey. But you're also of the opinion, I believe, that some of the positive economic news that we've gotten recently may start to soften up a little bit.
Yeah, to some extent, Susan, I think one of the things that's really driven this market has been positive economic surprises. The economy in the United States has gotten better than we thought. No one thought we'd have two back-to-back 3% GDP quarters, for example. And not only that, but a year ago, no one thought we would have a global synchronized recovery where everyone around the globe is growing. That is that those surprises have really helped lift the market. The problem going into next year is that now everyone knows that, and even if the economy remains fairly healthy, it will no longer surprise, and thereby will no longer impress and continue to drive equity markets higher. And to your point, if it fades a little bit, which I think could happen, then we could be disappointed and be a struggle for the market. It's also, there's reasons to suspect a slowdown. We've backed up long-term bond yields. The Fed has raised rates several times. The dollar has backed up. Financial liquidity for one of the rare times in this recovery has contracted in the last 6 months. GDP has actually grown faster than the money supply, so there's less liquidity left for the financial markets. And then I just kind of think sentiment has gotten a little ahead of itself for one of the rare times. What's really driven this market has been a wall of worry. Mm-hmm. Maybe for the first time that's dissipating, and that lends itself to maybe having it pull back.
Kevin, let me ask you about monetary policy. There's a theory going around right now that, you know, let's face it, we've had a very good run since the March of 2009 for the U.S. stock market, and it's fueled in large part by the low interest rates that the Fed has put into place. Now, as they begin to raise those rates, as Jim is referring to, can you still see the stock market continuing higher? There are those who feel it has to go the other direction.
Well, not necessarily. The market has been fueled by an expectation for the pedal to the metal, both monetary policy and now fiscal policy. We're not talking about tax hikes, and and interest rates are still well below the inflation rate. So both of those engines are on full throttle right now. And if we get to a point where the Fed has gone too far, then that could cause a problem. But if you look at what the market expectations are, they're really not seeing much by way of interest rate increases from here. So, yes, if you got a big spike in interest rates and it was a surprise and a shock to the market, that could end the bull market. But that's not what the market seems to be expecting at the moment. And the new appointments to the Fed don't suggest a reversal, of course, there either.
All right. So, Jim, you would position yourself a little bit more defensively. And I see from my notes here, you would move equity exposure away from the United States. Where would you be putting money to work, either here or abroad?
Yeah, I would be overweighted in international markets, both emerging and developed, Sue. I think they're going to have less pressure than the United States stock market is in the next year. And then I guess I would have a barbell approach a little bit. I would stay with more of the inflationary sort of plays. I like the energy stocks, which have been out of favor, but do well if interest rates rise and do well if inflation pressures continue to pick up. I'd also look at the industrials right now with GE and the like. They've really beaten down that sector, and I think it could be a bit of a value play in here of late, and also benefit from reinflation pressures. I'd still hold on to technology, but I might back off a little bit overall. I'd be very careful of going to the traditional defensive sectors like utilities and telecoms and consumer staples, because I think they have extreme downside risk to rising yields.
And, by the way, the utilities hit an all-time high today, too, as well. So, Jim Paulson of the Luthold Group, Kevin Caron with Washington Crossing Advisors. Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. There are reports tonight that the White House is considering nominating Mohammed El-Erian to be vice chair of the central bank. He is the former PIMCO CEO and the current chief economic advisor at Allianz. He's also been a guest here on Nightly Business Report. The president recently nominated Jerome Powell to be the chair of the Federal Reserve.
Speaking of which, the Fed is keeping a close watch on inflation, which has come in consistently below its 2% target, but it may be starting to pick up. Just today, we learned that prices at the wholesale level climbed more than expected over the past year. In fact, producer prices rose 0.4%, their biggest annual gain in more than 5 years.
Still ahead, food fight. Will more private equity firms want to take a bite out of casual dining brands? The U.S. Postal Service reported a loss last year of more than $2.5 billion. It's the 11th straight year in the red. The reasons are pretty familiar. People are sending less mail, and pension and health care costs are rising. The Postmaster General is asking for more freedom to raise stamp prices as a way to help generate revenue. The good news? It's forecasting another strong holiday season of package deliveries.
Speaking of which, small businesses were more optimistic last month. According to a monthly survey of the National Federation of Independent Business, business owners expect sales to be higher, and they think that now is a good time to expand. However, some also say that they want to hire, but they're having a hard time finding qualified applicants.
Shares of Buffalo Wild Wings soared today on a takeover report that we told you about last night. The company has reportedly received an offer from the private equity firm Roark Capital, and that sent the stock up nearly 24%. If a deal does get done, it wouldn't be the first fast casual company to go private, and it likely won't be the last. Kate Rogers has more.
Private equity firms seem to have an appetite for acquiring names in the restaurant space. The latest, Roark Capital making a bid to take over Buffalo Wild Wings. The company also owns Arby's, Jimmy John's, and more. So who might be the next takeover target? While fast food names like McDonald's and Restaurant Brands International have continued to thrive this year, casual dining names and fast casual names have been hit hard, making them attractive for potential buyouts. Analysts say names like Noodles & Company and Zoe's Kitchen, with smaller market caps and consumer struggles, may be on the radar are next. Another beaten-down name, Cheesecake Factory, which has fallen some 25% for the year, could make sense as a future acquisition, although it is a riskier move given its exposure to malls, which have also been struggling for foot traffic as consumer behaviors change. There's also been chatter of two other restaurant bids in recent weeks. First, JAB Holding Company, which owns Panera as well as Caribou Coffee and Keurig, eyeing Dunkin' Donuts, and Apollo Global Management potentially making a bid for Qdoba Mexican Eats. One name that has analysts split as a possible acquisition target is Chipotle. The stock can't seem to escape its food safety woes, which resurfaced this week after actor Jeremy Jordan posted on social media that he had been hospitalized after eating at the fast casual chain. Chipotle reached out to the actor and said they investigated and that they could not confirm his illness was due to eating their food. The stock is down over 25% year to date, and while some say it could make for a worthwhile takeover, others say we may instead see more activist intervention to turn that brand around. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Kate Rogers.
TJX reports its worst sales growth in nearly a decade, and that's where we begin tonight's Market Focus. The off-price retailer said that its apparel offerings failed to appeal to customers, and as a result, revenue and same-store sales suffered. The company added that those hurricanes during the quarter also affected its results. The parent of HomeGoods and Marshalls also gave earnings guidance for the year that fell short of expectations. Shares of TJX fell nearly 4% as a result to $67.94. And despite a drop in same-store sales, Dick's Sporting Goods topped both profit and revenue expectations. The athletic apparel retailer said that planned investments will cause earnings next year to fall, though, by as much as 20%. That news sent the shares lower nearly 3% to $25.59. Advanced Auto Parts reported a decline in same-store sales and revenue that missed analysts' expectations, but the car parts retailer did beat on earnings and reported a smaller-than-expected decline in profit margins. The company also reaffirmed its outlook for the year. Shares took off, rising 16% today to $95.72. Sue?
Bill, semiconductor equipment maker Kulicke & Soffa said stronger demand for its products helped profits and sales top estimates. The company's forecast for the current quarter also outpaced the street targets. So shares jumped 20% to $28.52. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is cutting its position in IBM. A regulatory filing shows the conglomerate cut its stake in the PC maker by nearly 32% to 37 million shares. Shares reacted to that news, initially falling in after-hours trading. They ended the regular session up just a fraction to 148.89. And the online auto marketplace Car Gurus reported its financial results for the first time since going public last month. After the bell, the company reported profits and sales that topped expectations, saying a rise in subscription revenue from dealers helped its results. Shares initially spiked in extended trading after closing the regular session up about 1% at $29.82.
And certainly investors have been closely watching tax reform discussions in Washington. And today it appeared as if Senate Republicans were injecting health care into that debate as well. There are reports that a repeal of the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate will now be included in the Senate's tax reform proposal. The House version that's expected to be voted on Thursday does not currently include that repeal.
Well, there's also been a lot of talk in the tax plan about potential cuts to the popular mortgage deduction. But there's an even bigger cut in the House tax plan that could hit affordable housing pretty hard. Diana Olick is in Washington tonight.
America desperately needs more affordable rental housing. But buildings like these are less lucrative for developers than fancy buildings like these, which command much higher rents. That's why the government entices developers to build low-income housing with a tax credit and something called private activity bonds, which are tax-free.
Multifamily affordable housing that then gets a loan at a below-market interest rate because there's a tax exemption.
But the House tax bill wipes out the bonds, which also hurts developers' ability to get the low-income housing tax credits because the two are linked. Without the bonds, developers will have little incentive to build thousands of affordable apartments.
The bonds access the credits, but together it's 50%, it's 50,000 units, it's 50,000 households that will go without this really critically needed affordable housing. Families, seniors, veterans, homeless people, people with special needs are all going to be denied this housing. It's a devastating reduction.
Republicans backed the cut, saying the federal government should not subsidize the borrowing costs of private businesses. This as the Trump administration touts public-private partnerships in both housing and infrastructure, which the bonds support. Housing advocates in Texas and Florida are condemning the cut, saying these bonds are needed to repair and rebuild housing after Hurricanes Harvey and Irma.
Losing these bonds could reduce the supply of affordable housing by 1 million units over the next decade, according to one accounting firm. This as the supply of low-priced homes for sale is at a record low. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Diana Olick in Washington.
Coming up, going, gone. A foreclosure auction comes to Manhattan's Trophy Tower. What to watch tomorrow. We have a slew of economic reports due out, including business inventories and the consumer price index, which is a measure of inflation. Retail sales for the month of October will be released, and we will hear from Dow component Cisco Systems, which is expected to report its financial results. That's what we are watching for Wednesday.
So we need your help for an upcoming program on retirement. On Thanksgiving, we will examine the crisis that we hear about all the time. So tell us about your biggest challenge when it comes to saving for retirement. Have no savings at all? We want to hear from you. Go to our website, nbr.com, click on Contact Us, and tell us your story. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. And if you have a question about saving for retirement, our experts may be able to help. Email a short video to nbrmail@cnbc.com. Bill?
Household debt reached a new record, according to a report from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It was the 13th straight quarterly increase. Mortgages account for more than two-thirds of total household debt here in the U.S., even as auto and student loans also continue to grow. But delinquencies are also rising, especially auto loans made to subprime borrowers by auto finance companies.
Well, the richest 1% of the world's population owns more than half of the world's household wealth. A new report from Credit Suisse also says income inequality is going to get worse over the coming years, with millennials having a particularly tough time. The researchers say inequality is largely the result of the financial crisis because financial assets have been growing faster than non-financial ones.
Finally tonight, it's called 157 because that's its address here in the heart of New York City. But it is more than just another Manhattan high-rise. When it opened 3 years ago, 157 was considered a symbol of extravagance, drawing the world's billionaires to its apartments with breathtaking views, among many other amenities. But 3 years later, those record-setting sales have gone from boom to a sort of a bust. Robert Frank has more.
Last week, Unit 79 of the skyscraper named 157 became the biggest foreclosure sale ever in New York City, auctioned off for $36 million. The owner was Kola Aluko, a Nigerian billionaire charged with money laundering and fraud. Now, real estate brokers said it was an outlier and that the market is strong. But an analysis of sales at 157 shows that every apartment that has sold since the building opened in 2014 has declined in value, all by double digits. Jonathan Miller of Miller Samuel Appraisers ran the numbers. A unit on the 62nd floor was purchased for over $31 million. 2 years later, it sold for $23.5 million, a 26% decline. A unit on the 65th floor was bought for $29 million and sold for just $22 million this past April. Prices for new condo developments across Manhattan have fallen 27% this year. The average sale price is still more than $4.3 million, or $2,500 a square foot. There are currently 16 apartments listed for sale at 157 today, the most expensive for $70 million. One apartment that is not on the market is the famed penthouse on the 75th and 76th floor that hedge fund billionaire Bill Ackman purchased for over $91 million. He has said he expects to be able to sell it for more than twice that. Of course, that's not likely anytime soon. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Robert Frank.
And that is Nightly Business Report for tonight. I'm Sue Herrera. Thanks for joining us.
And I'm Bill Griffith. Have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow.